Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:31 p.m. on Tuesday, February 24th, 2015. Present today, we have Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Edgman, Representative Wilson, Representative Gutenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please make sure your cell phones are off. We don't want to mess up the recording equipment. On today's schedule, we're going to hear from the Governor's appointee for Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Commissioner Designee Randall Hoffbeck, and we will have our first hearing on House Bill 26. Our first order of business will be the confirmation hearing of Commissioner Designee Randall Hoffbeck. Mr. Hoffbeck, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and then tell us about yourself and along with your qualifications to serve as a Commissioner of Revenue.
Chairman Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Hoffbeck. I call myself the Commissioner of Revenue. I guess I'm the Commissioner Designee. I thought probably a good way to start would just to be kind of walk through my qualifications and how I got to where I am today, rather than just having to jump back and forth through the resume that way. I came to Alaska in 1980, fresh out of college with a degree in resource management from the University of Minnesota School of Forestry. It was an interdisciplinary degree that dealt with the socioeconomic impacts of development, primarily in a forest-related area. Came up working for the Bureau of Land Management with the idea of being a park ranger. I was going to come to Alaska for 2 years and see the sights and then move on to the next challenge. Like many people, I fell in love with Alaska and never left. The job itself didn't pan out the way that I'd intended, but it really started me on a career path that that I've continued to follow. The when I first got up here, I first got to Alaska, I was assigned to the State Office of the Bureau of Land Management, and at that point in time, Jimmy Carter put a hiring freeze on. President Carter put a hiring freeze on. They couldn't put me into the slot that they'd hired me for, and so I started doing land law adjudication, primarily adjudicating land claims under ANCSA and then ANILCA after that. So I did that for about a year and a half, and in my early 20s decided that sitting behind a desk wasn't the job I was looking for, so I resigned that position, formed a building company. We started building houses in the Eagle River, Peters Creek, and Wasilla area, and also did appraisals and sold real estate. I did that for about 3 years, and then some issues with my business partner. The business had to be disbanded, and I took a job with the Municipality of Anchorage on their appraisal crew. Through the years, I worked my way up through the ranks to senior appraiser, and then finally, for the last 6 years, I was the appraisal supervisor for the Municipality of Anchorage. I started in 83. In 1992, the North Slope Borough decided that they needed to form an oil and gas audit team because the state had cut back on their audits. And the borough was concerned that the property tax revenue would not be sufficient or would not be accurate. And so they put together a team to develop an audit program. Again, working up through the ranks of being the senior oil and gas appraiser for the North Slope Borough and finally the tax manager. Did that until the late 90s when I had an opportunity to go back and use my degree for a short period of time when Mayor Maestrom appointed me as Parks and Beautification Manager in Anchorage. Did that for about a year and a half, and as his administration was winding down, I had an opportunity to join with two other individuals and bid on the contract to do the tax administration support for the Department of Revenue. We bid and got that job, and we did that until 2001 when I was offered the State Petroleum Property Assessor position. I held that job from 2001 to 2006, and within that point in time, we actually rewrote the administrative regs for 4356. It was also the time during the Governor Murkowski's administration when we were negotiating the stranded gas line. So I spent 2 years on Governor Murkowski's gas line negotiation team during that period of time. In 2006, the North Slope Borough's finance director had announced that he was going to retire. The North Slope Borough asked if I would be interested in coming north to be the director of administration and finance, which I did. Went up there, spent a year with the finance director before he retired, and then took over as finance director in 2007, and held that position until 2011, when the when Mayor Brower was elected, she appointed me chief of staff. And that was 1 year. I'm one of the lucky tier one employees. I was 54 at that point in time, so that worked out perfectly. By being the chief of staff, I got to spend a year with the person that was following me into the position of director of administration and finance, so we were able to do that transition as well. In just to put some context about that job, too, the North Slope Borough is kind of a miniature state of Alaska as far as their dependence on oil and gas and a lot of the issues that they deal with. And the job was very similar to the job, this position as Commissioner of Revenue, with actually a few more duties as well. As the Director of Administration and Finance for North Slope Borough, I was the Chief Investment Officer for the borough. And that's no small task. The borough at any given time, with their bond monies, their permanent fund, and their operating monies, would have about $1 billion in investments at any given time. I was the Chief Financial Officer. I was the Budget Manager. I was the Debt Manager. And I was the Treasurer for the borough. So that was kind of the job as Chief Financial Officer included. I also was in charge of accounting, within my department, accounting, grants, benefits, risk management, insurance purchasing, shipping and receiving, and records management. So it was a pretty broad job description. In 2012, I retired as the chief of staff and completed a seminary degree, one that I've been working on for 3 years. I spent 2 years completing that degree, have a master's in pastoral counseling and a master's of divinity, and was really heading off in that direction as my next career. I spent 30 years dealing with tax and land law issues and was moving on to another career when Governor Walker approached me and asked if I would consider being the commissioner of revenue. Did some real soul searching. I'm going to throw a little pastor at you. I did some praying. And my wife and I decided that really everything that I'd done in my entire career kind of led to this particular job. It wasn't a job that was ever on my horizon. I was happy with my career that I had had. But the opportunity to work with this governor and on the issues that are in front of the state right now, the budget issues, the opportunity to work moving a gas line forward, it was more than I could pass up. So I had one last question that I asked him that was, I think, real telling. He said, are we going to spend 4 years trying to get reelected, or are we going to spend 4 years doing the job? And he said, we're going to do the job. And I said, then I'm in. And so that's kind of what gets us to where I'm at today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hoffbeck. We're going to go to the committee now for some questions. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoffbeck. You may have to do some soul searching when you get done with this confirmation process. So, first off, let me ask you, I'm going to try and build up to a couple questions here, is what is your understanding of the role of the department and the role of the duties if you're confirmed as commissioner?
Well, the department itself is to collect and manage the revenues of the state of Alaska. And as commissioner, my job is to essentially support and make policy decisions for the department in that role.
Support and make policy decisions. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Can you just
follow up? Go right ahead.
So just support and help the governor make policy decisions on revenues for the state.
Help the governor make policy decisions, then also give the, through the chair, make policy decisions and to direct my staff with policy as well.
Okay.
So follow up. Go ahead. Keep going.
With that, thank you. I have a couple here. With that, where do you see the makeup of the state's revenue in 3 or 4 or 5 years? What is going to be the general makeup of the state's revenue incomes?
I think that's going to be, there's going to be some very difficult discussions between now and 3 or 4 years from now, particularly depending upon what happens with oil prices. We can't live on our savings forever, and over the next couple of years, we're going to be largely filling the budget gap with our with the savings that have been set aside during the high revenue years. I think the we're going to have a discussion within the next year on whether we need to look at broad-based taxes, whether we need to look at changing fee structures, whether we need to look at spending, putting in some kind of spending program using investment earnings from the permanent fund. We may have to go back and revisit oil and gas taxes. And obviously, we're going to have to look at cutting programs. And all of those are going to be issues that are on the table. I don't know that I can tell you which ones will be a part of the revenue picture 3 years from now, but I think that discussion is going to be need to be had between now and 3 years from now.
We have been joined by Representative Guerra, Pruitt, and Munoz.
So basically, you mentioned a permanent fund dividend, which is about a larger pot of money out there. That would probably be one of your discussions with the governor.
Absolutely. I think the governor's made it clear that everything would be on the table. Obviously, it's a balance. Every one of those is a difficult decision. Now, the permanent fund itself would not be at risk, nor would necessarily the dividend, but there are the earnings, the undesignated earnings that would be available for expenditure. It could be expended right now if the legislature chose to.
Other members.
Okay.
So in light of the basically a dismissal from one of our former commissioners, Commissioner DOT, you know, it was a lot of people felt that he gave a report to the governor on some projects, some capital type projects. I know when I talked to him, he said, I was just trying to let him know what my opinion was and how these projects would go forward. He didn't last very long as commissioner after that. So I know with my staff, I tell them very clearly, I want your advice. I want you to give me your advice straight up. When you're the commissioner, do you have your own voice or do you work with the governor and do the governor's voice? Are you going to be stand autonomous and have your own voice in these discussions with the governor? Do you feel that you have the ability to do that?
To the chair, Representative Newman. I do feel that I have a voice with the governor. I do have one advantage in that I've had a relationship with the governor for over 20 years, dealing with various oil and gas tax issues. I was on the Port Authority for a time with the governor when the governor was the counsel for the Port Authority. We agreed on issues sometimes. We disagreed on issues sometimes. And I found the governor to always be very professional about in the way that he responded. He has made it very clear to everyone that I've been with that he wants to hear differing opinions. He wants to hear the pros and cons of the issues. The only thing he says, though, that once the decision is made, then we march with that decision. We've had some very open and robust conversations already, and I have no indication from the governor that he wants anything but total feedback.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Representative Gaddis has joined us also. Randy, SB 138 created a municipal advisory group, which back in 2005 under the Stranded Gas Act, under Governor Murkowski, you and I both dealt a lot together because I was on it for the city of Fairbanks when I was mayor. Where is it today with the property tax legislation that the governor we thought was going to introduce this season, and is he going to introduce that bill this session?
Chairman Thompson, I'm not sure that there will be a property tax bill that will make it forward for this session, but let me kind of explain where we are in the process. We met last Friday with the Municipal Advisory Group. We'd met earlier and met in January and had reconfirmed that a PILT structure was something that they were comfortable with. So we met last Friday and put some structure around a PILT, walked them, spent about we spent the better part of a day, and we walked through the PILT structure and the various components that would be used in calculating the PILT. It actually turns out to be more of a formula-driven value than a PILT. Everybody that was in the meeting and online was comfortable with the direction that it had gone. In fact, we're very confident that it was acceptable. They have asked us for actually run some models with that pilt structure, and if possible, against several LNG projects from around the world, just to see how the pilt would play out over time. We have a meeting scheduled for March 13th to review that. We're actually going to send them the model this week, as well as a document on the that was done during stranded gas on impact payments during construction. And on the 13th, we're hoping to get total concurrence from the group, and so we can put the pilt during operations portion, move it over to the AK LNG negotiation group so they can start factoring it into the economics of the project. And we will then begin the discussion on impact payments during construction. And at that point, meeting on the 13th, we intend to have a representative from FERC there as well, and see whether, in fact, the MAG group might adopt the FERC process for impact payments and essentially take that off the table as well. So that would take care of everything that AKLNG needs as far as what they need for the economics of the project. There will be one more discussion that we need to have, which will be probably the more difficult discussion, because although the pilt structure will define the total take during operations, the one last discussion is going to be how those revenues will be allocated around the state. And that's really a discussion between the state and the municipalities rather than the pipeline and the municipalities. And so that will be the third piece. But the first two pieces should get put everything in play within the negotiation process and allow that to go forward. Until something comes out of the process, we really won't have anything to bring before the legislature. And we don't want to get too far ahead of it. Because if you think about it, if we've got a $50 billion pipeline and a 20 mil levy, that's $1 billion a year in property taxes. That's a significant portion of the total take on the pipeline. And so I think it really needs to have some flexibility within the economic modeling of the pipeline rather than lock it down tight early and then have to build everything around it. And so it may come out in time for this session, but I'm reluctant to say that it will.
Back when I chaired that municipal advisory group, and you and I worked together for 2 years, one of the big concerns was the pilt and the impact to the communities and advanced payments so communities could be prepared for the massive amounts of workers that are going to be there. Is that being addressed in this municipal advisory group, that we have to have money ahead of time before construction starts?
That will be, Chairman Thompson, that will be brought up starting on March 13th. We will start working on those impact payments.
I know that there's some concern that I've heard that the governor isn't meeting the current schedule, and it seems like it's getting delayed a little too long, but I see you are going to be meeting again March 13th and continuing to meet. How often does that municipal advisory group meet?
They've been trying to meet once a month, but in the last meeting we were sensitive to the fact that we don't want to be a delaying factor, so we're going to try and meet every 2 weeks. And one of the things that I think we need to make clear too, and something that we lost sight of for a while, is that the biggest player on property taxes within the gas, with this gas line, is the state of Alaska. So it isn't just a municipal issue. It's actually a significant revenue stream to the state of Alaska as well, and a constant revenue stream, one that won't fluctuate with gas prices. And so we're also looking at this as a significant state issue as well as a municipal issue.
We'll move on to some other committee members. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, a lot of the questions I was going to ask were asked by other co-chairs. I suspect, seeing the press here, the lead is already set, but so I'll ask some other questions here. I'd appreciate your thoughts, Commissioner Desney, on the Department of Revenue's ability to predict state revenue. If you're confident in it, it's been revised, if you plan any changes for it, just your general thoughts, please.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, predicting the revenues is difficult at best. And it's even made more difficult when we're focusing entirely on one revenue stream or one primary revenue stream. I don't anticipate changing the process that was used. I think it's been in place for a lot of years, and quite frankly, nobody can predict oil prices. I think we do as well as anybody does on that. But I think if over time we broaden our revenue sources that we use, that we'll actually be able to balance one stream against the other, and we'll be much more accurate in predicting a revenue going forward. But until that decision's made, and we're still relying totally on oil and gas tax revenue, the state has taken a pretty conservative approach to it, but nobody predicted oil prices that would happen now.
Very good.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I guess extend that a little bit. You answered to some degree with that all issues, all options are on the table. Can you give me your philosophical thoughts and your views of who should pay the cost of public services? What role should industry play? Should the people of Alaska pay? Should the municipalities play in paying for the cost of services that people have grown to expect?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The pay-as-you-go theory is nice, but it doesn't work very well. I do believe in fees. I think fees that are tied to the cost of providing service to the extent that they're possible, I think make a lot of sense so that they have a direct impact on the users. But there's a broader range of services that government provides that simply are not necessarily fee-driven, and it really is kind of a accumulation of wealth and a dispersion of wealth that the government takes on. And so you've got a large taxpayer like the oil and gas industry. Obviously, the share of the tax burden that they're paying far exceeds the impact that they're having on negative impacts they're having on the state. But yet, that's a revenue source that the state has and can use for financing other projects and operations. And I think that's totally appropriate.
Last follow up for good.
Follow up.
Would you predict that you'll expand? Try and raise more money through expanding revenues through royalties on fishing or mineral extraction other than oil and gas? Would that be part of the kit of tools you have that you might go to?
Through the chair, Representative Sandler, that would certainly be on the table as well. I actually just met with the Alaska Miners Association, it's the other mining group this morning. And talk to them just to get an idea of what their actual margins were within the mining industry. Obviously, they don't have the same kind of margins that we have within oil and gas. But I think everybody that we've talked to, and we've made it very clear that everybody's going to need to be a participant as they go forward, and everybody's agreed that's likely going to be the case. And so the kind of the parting question that we had with the miners this morning was, tell us what we can do to help as long as it's not going to cost us money to do so. And also tell us what it is that we need to not to do so that we don't get in the way of their growth during this time. But I think everybody anticipates the fact that we're going to have to broaden those revenue bases. It's just how much, and one of the commitments we've made with the various industries is that we will work with them in making those determinations. We aren't just going to throw a number out there and expect them to accept it. So
it's a brand new day.
Thank you. Brand new day.
Next we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, Commissioner. You have a long history in appraising, particularly in petroleum, and the TAPS valuation from 2014. Of course, it went through some litigation, and it was a contentious debate. Pipeline owners believed it to be worth $2.7 billion. Municipalities estimated it close to $13.8 and Department of Revenue came in with a low figure of 5.8. Eventually, SARB said it was somewhere closer to 10.2. What do you think about those differences in opinions of what the value of TAPS is?
To the chair, Representative Kawasaki, let me take you back about 10 years, actually a little more than that. When I was a state oil and gas property assessor, we actually had 3 years of essentially a settled agreement on the value of TAPS. The last year that I was the assessor, that agreement had expired. We did some work to try and determine what the value should be going forward. We found some real issues with the way the pipeline had been valued in the past, and in fact, the way pipelines were valued nationally, that we didn't feel like that discounting a regulated rate indicated market value of an asset. In fact, so we argued as the state that essentially it was a use value, that as long as that pipeline was operating, that it had a value based on its use, not on the rate of return on its regulated tariff, because it's on regulated tariffs on a declining rate base. And so at some point in time, there's very little revenue that's generated by a very active pipeline. We argued that case that went all the way up through the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court agreed with the position the state took that it is a use value. They did, however, modify some of the assumptions based on additional information that was brought forward during the trial, and actually raised the value from the value the state had put on the pipeline. That essentially is the law right now. It is being valued as a use value. The industry still believes the pipeline should be valued up based on its regulated rate base, but I think it's very clear that it's not the case in Alaska anymore. It's not really as a matter of trying to refine the inputs into that cost-based model that determines use. Last year, the state made some decisions using a partially the state, the Supreme Court decision, and partially from the following Superior Court decision on the 2007-8-9 case, which has been argued and is waiting for a Supreme Court decision right now. And when I came in to this position, I sat down with the current state assessor and we worked through those, and I think we've got a more focused idea of how to value it this year. But since those values haven't come out yet, I don't really want to talk about them yet, but it'll be a more focused decision. We have worked diligently with the municipalities and the owners. In fact, we met about 2 weeks ago we actually brought a mediator in to try and resolve, which is 10 years of litigation now on the value of TAPS. We didn't make it to a final decision. But I believe once the value comes out, at least the industry has indicated they're interested in reengaging in the discussions as well as some of the municipalities.
So can I have a follow-up question? Thank you. And so I guess I'm just a little unclear. So will you be arguing on behalf of the state in front of the Supreme Court? You will be required to.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I actually pulled back from the TAPS litigation last year and did not participate. This year, for the mediation, I actually sought an attorney general's opinion on whether, in fact, I was conflicted from being a part of the mediation, because I've actually been on the state side for part of the time and on the municipalities for part of the time. Both the industry and the municipalities asked that I be a part of it, and so the Attorney General then said, then by all means, participate. Obviously, the Attorney General's conflicted, too. It was who he had assigned it to. And so I did participate in those mediations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg and then Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to get back to the PILT. The LNG project comes off of the North Slope through the North Slope borough. The next borough in line is the Fairbanks North Star borough, and it just nicks the corner. Before it goes farther down the highway, it impacts other boroughs as well. Even though it just nicks, and I think it's only 20 miles, about 20 miles projected the current route through the borough, all those impacts from probably the entire midpoint of the project are going to impact the Fairbanks North Star borough in the city. But based upon a mileage plan, the borough is not going to receive much of that impact money. The state will. And how do you perceive the state mitigating those impacts with or without participating with the borough on what happens? You know, I've lived through the TAPS and there's not many people in the state understand the impacts that happen to the community of the state when a project like that hits again. It's unimaginable. Imagine thinking it happening again. Imagine what happened last time. But how do you think the state will mitigate the borough's costs that aren't going to be the borough's not going to be able to collect them because the project literally physically only nicks the borough?
To the chair, Representative Gutenberg, there's a couple components to that question. One is impact during construction, which is what Fairbanks will feel probably the most. Not as much during operation, but certainly during construction. There will be some property tax base in Fairbanks at that point in time because of the pipe yards and the equipment and such that will be there. But certainly, I think that came out most profoundly in the impact study that was done by Information Insights during the stranded gas that went back and looked at just the massive impacts on Fairbanks with schools and crime and various other issues that they dealt with during the initial pipeline days. And so there is going to be substantial impact on the Fairbanks area, and that is what the discussion that we're going to pick up in March 13th to start working through those issues. It's anticipated that the funding for that will come primarily from the project, but as you stated, I mean there could be a state component to that as well. But we haven't got that far down the line, but we are very sensitive to it. And aware of the impacts that Fairbanks will feel. One bright side is Fairbanks is bigger than it used to be, and it's more diverse and a little bit more capable of absorbing some of those issues than it was the first time, but there will definitely be an impact that needs to be dealt with.
Another question, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So getting back to the pipeline assessment question, and I guess I'm caught up in my job. I read the Gleason decision. So after that decision on the valuation, every time there's another assessment, they turn around and it goes into court again. It gets sued again. I want to make sure that the state's in a strong position to keep up its obligation to its tax base and defending itself. And how long do you think that, I mean, I know you talked about mitigation with the industry, but how long is this going to go on?
To the chair, Representative Gutenberg, I had high hopes that we were going to progress further than we did in the mediation. Everybody is weary of the litigation. Right now, like I said, the 2007-09 is before the Supreme Court. Starting with 2010 forward, it hasn't even gone to Superior Court yet. And so there's a tremendous amount of litigation that's waiting to occur, really waiting on probably this second Supreme Court decision, which I believe, based on the arguments, will reaffirm their initial decision and maybe fine-tune a few issues. At that point in time, I'm hoping that there'll be so few moving parts left that everybody will be able to simply sit down and calculate a value that they're comfortable with. The state has had trouble keeping up with the litigation costs or what they've dedicated to litigation costs, and they've dedicated a substantial amount of money, but nothing compared to what the industry and the municipalities have dedicated to it. And largely, the state's been caught in the middle. I mean, they're the taxing authority, but they have one party that says it's too low and another party that says it's too high, and so essentially, the state has gone in and set the foundation for what they've done, and then step back and let the other two parties really duke it out. We want to be more proactive and actually not necessarily be more proactive in the litigation, but more proactive in trying to bring the parties together. I would like to not have another court case on taps, and I think everybody realizes that the difference between what could be achieved in going to court and what the values are, there's really not enough there to make it worthwhile for anybody. So it really is a matter of everybody being able to stand down. So the discussion I had with the municipalities and industry actually last week was the state is more than willing to put a range of possible solutions on the table and ask if everybody's willing to come in at that range and then stretch to the middle to try and get it resolved. And I do think that people are ready to do that.
Thank you.
Changing direction a little bit, Mr. Hoffbeck, what's the Department of Revenue's role in Walker's pipeline ownership strategy, and what is your role?
Well, as you know, that on the ownership on the second pipeline, obviously the governor has just recently released that. Our job will be to look at financing options to see just how much of a equity stake we can afford in the pipeline versus how much we'd have to bring in equity partners and how that would be structured. And we will have to work through our investment consultants. We don't have that expertise in-house to make some of those calls on an international pipeline. So, but our job will be primarily on the financing side of the equation and secondarily on the revenue side on what's being generated to make sure that the structure, ownership structure, actually generates a reasonable rate of return to the state of Alaska.
It looks, there's two projects, and basically it's looking more like they're going to be in competition with each other, and you're on the board. It looks like, wouldn't this be a conflict of interest for your part?
I actually am not on the AGDC board.
Okay.
I'm specifically excluded from that by SB 138. Both myself and Commissioner Myers cannot sit on that board. And because we have not signed the confidentiality agreements, we have not been privy to the confidential information concerned with AKLNG. So we're both kind of still able to move in either direction with this because we aren't privy to the foundational information. But there are going to be some difficult decisions to make on how we split our teams so that we do keep that wall of information between the two projects, recognizing that the governor made it very clear that what he's trying to do is use this to move the project along. He feels like competition is a good thing and that he's concerned that if we move down the line with AKLNG and then the industry decides that this really is a project that they don't want to participate in, that we would be 3 or 4 years down the road and not have any options. And so seeing that it's critical that by the early 20s, 2022, 2023, we need to have this additional revenue source in place or have to make some very significant changes in how the state operates. He's used it as a way to try and keep the project moving forward and to give the state some options. So.
To follow up along that line of questioning, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffbeck, I see an issue with probably some huge investments that are required by the state. You just stated that your primary role in any gas line would be to advise the governor on revenue options. But if you don't have access to all the information that's available, I don't understand how you can do that and advise the governor. I understand that the deputy commissioner of the natural resources has signed the confidentiality agreement so that she's in the loop. But the governor hasn't, you haven't, the two other commissioners that sit on AGDC boards haven't. How are you supposed to advise the governor on making decisions on a gas pipeline if you don't have access to all the information? And how's
through the chair, Representative Newman. I do have my deputy commissioner of revenue, Donna Keppers, has also signed the confidentiality agreements and has been part of the negotiations as well. Certainly the Attorney General's office is working with the sponsor team to try and come up with a new definition of what is confidential and what isn't. Recognize the fact there are going to be certain documents that need to remain confidential and some that really could be presented in the public. The idea being that the default should be transparency, not confidentiality. But documents that need to remain confidential will remain confidential. And I think at that point in time when that decision, when those parameters are put in place, that I think at that point in time, Commissioner Myers and myself will probably sign the confidentiality agreement so that we have access to the additional information. But the idea is to really get as much information out in the public as possible.
I think what I heard, Mr. Pilcher, is that you're going to go back and look at the definition of confidentiality, and I don't know if those definitions were put in the statute in 138. I thought that there was maybe some language there that described what could be accessible and what could not be accessible, because there's certain business plans in there that they don't want public, just because of the fiduciary responsibilities that they have. But you're looking at changing what your definitions are for confidentiality so that you have the ability to sign confidential agreements. Is that what I heard?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the Attorney General's office is looking at what is being has been classified as confidential and working with the sponsor group to try and refine that down to just the minimum of what needs to be confidential. Obviously, there's a tendency to want to keep everything confidential. It's just easier when you don't have to make those decisions. But as I understand it, and I'm not working at the Attorney General's office, is that they're putting together some form of matrix that would help identify confidential documents, which ones are and which ones are not. I think once everybody's comfortable with it, that as much as possible is in the public domain, then the governor will be more comfortable with assigning the confidentiality agreements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Next we have Representative Guerra, then Wilson, then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffbeck, you might be one of the most important revenue generators we have left at this point as a person, and this is why I say it. When I started in this state, I started as an assistant attorney general, and one of the first things I learned was about the Amaretta Hess case, where the state was underpaid by over $1 billion for royalties that were owed to the state. Some companies take very seriously their duty to pay their taxes as due, and some companies will try and stretch their deduction abilities. So right now we're faced with low oil prices, negative production tax revenue over the next few years, and some of the only oil revenue we may get is through audits under ACEs, if companies have underpaid their taxes. We don't know if they have. Here's my question. For a number of years, I was told by prior people in your position, they were on top of those ACEs audits. It's 2014 now. ACEs was passed in 2007. We still haven't completed a single ACEs audit, I don't think. We may be owed nothing from underpaid taxes. We may be owed billions for underpaid taxes. So what can you tell me about what you're going to do to make sure we get paid every single penny that we're due? And are we running a risk that we're not going to be able to fully audit companies because of how late we are in the auditing process?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, a couple of answers there. First of all, I, too, was sensitive to the fact that we are bumping up against some of our statutory deadlines as far as being able to audit. I have met with the audit staff on several occasions and have been assured that we will not miss any statutory deadlines as far as getting audits out. We've finished the last of the PPT audits now, and the staff was really in kind of a difficult situation. I mean, they were auditing PPT, ACEs, and SB 21 all at the same time. And plus bringing in a new tax management system, which was taking almost half their time. So there's reasons that things were delayed. That being said, it's not fair to the taxpayer and it's not fair to the state for people to have to wait 6 years for their tax returns to be audited. So we've put a plan in place to start catching up over the next 3 years so that we should be auditing within a 2 to 3 year cycle within 3 years. And so we're catching up 1 year each year over the next 3 years. As far as assuring that every penny is collected, we have well-trained audit staff. They with audit masters that essentially have the statute book memorized If you ever dealt with Lenny D's, you don't have to look anything up. You just ask him, he'll tell you where to find it. So I'm confident that the audits will be done well. The issue really is on areas of dispute. And in fact, I've got a meeting as soon as I get down here to meet with a representative from BP that wants to talk about some of the audit disputes that they see arising. And so I can assure you that the audits will be done timely, or they will be done before the statutory time frame runs out, and that they will be done well.
Thank you.
Follow-up question, Representative Guerra.
Yes. So help me not be skeptical here, and that this has nothing to do with you. But for a long time, the promises were we'll be on track on our audits. We're on the verge of hitting the statute of limitations deadline. I don't think you have any extra staff that the prior administration didn't have. So how is it that you're going to do these audits, number one, more quickly, but number two, in a way that is thorough enough that if we're owed a few hundred million dollars or maybe over $1 billion like the Amara Hess case, we will get all of that money?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, there's really three components here. One is that since we've implemented the tax management system, that allows us to bring a lot of the audit staff back to work. Secondly, the fact that we've completed the last of the PPT audits now allows us to be more focused on the ACEs. And third is that these audits have been worked all along. They bring them to finality as they're completed. But these haven't been sitting in a drawer for 6 years. They've been worked all along, and it's just so the results is what we're waiting for at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
That was my question.
Pardon?
That was my question. So if you
thank you, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate you being here. And looks like you have quite the resume. Sitting here going, can you keep down a job?
That's
just teasing. No, I really appreciate it. You bring a lot of experience and wealth of knowledge to this, and so looking forward to continuing to work with you. Some of the questions, and I want to feed a little bit off of what the co-chairs were asking about, is a little bit more information and understanding the direction that you feel as we kind of move forward on the gas line discussion. In your perspective, not the governor's, but your perspective, should we be pursuing the ASAP direction, or should we remain in the same pathway with the AKLNG? Which should be our focus?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I don't think those are mutually exclusive. I think the governor has made it very clear that he wants to continue to push the AKLNG project, and that the ASAP expansion of the ASAP project is just it's a second project, it's a competing project, but that he intends to move both projects along. And so I don't think that's mutually exclusive.
Continue.
Follow-up, Representative Pruitt.
So the previous administration had indicated that the ASAP project was more of a plan B. In your view, is that remain more of a plan B, still working towards both, but really with the intent that the ASAP is that plan B?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, as the governor has presented it, I think he's presented as a competing project, but as a it lags the other project. The reality is AKLNG will drive the agenda because ASAP can never catch up if AKLNG continues to progress forward. They've got at least a 1 year head start, and so AKLNG will still be the primary project. I don't know that the governor has called ASAP a backup project, but essentially that's how it's going to function as long as AKLNG continues to move forward.
And then one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Last follow-up, Representative Pruitt.
From your perspective as former the state assessor and your understanding of TAPS's role with municipalities and the tax base there,
would you bring that discussion to the table as we start talking about a smaller line owned by the state and the fact that there would not be the opportunities for those revenues for the municipalities? So municipalities would be losing out on opportunity to continue to fund their resources. Will you ensure that that discussion is brought up as we move forward in determining which one of those two projects that we would move forward with? Because I think the local communities, that's a huge impact that has to be part of our discussion.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that has already been discussed, as well as the impact of a state 25% share on the AKLNG project and the impacts it would have on revenue as well.
Right, thank you. And just one last. Yes, and I appreciate that. I mean, the last part, obviously, that's 25%, but I'd love to take money from people from other countries to help pay for the municipal services and in the communities throughout Alaska, and I think that's something that should be maintained in the discussion and the importance that will have in moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Is there anyone else in the room or online that would like to testify? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Designee, my ears perked up when I heard you say specifically that you see ASAP as a competing project, and I guess my question would be, why would the people we were hoping to partner with, that being the producers, want to continue cooperating with the state on the AKLNG project if the governor wants the ASAP project to be a competitor? A square is not a circle.
No. To the chair, Representative Sadler, I think it really is more an idea of leveling the playing field. I mean, each of these producers that are part of this project have competing projects around the world as well. And they're balancing the returns that they can achieve from this project with the returns they can achieve from other projects. So they have competing projects as well. Essentially, this does a little more than level the playing field. I think the governor needs to convince everybody that we are still negotiating in good faith, which we are. But I think the initial shock of the announcement probably has set people back. But we will continue, and he has made that very clear, to push the AKLNG project. If there's an economic benefit to the owners of the gas and in building the project, there's no reason for them not to continue to move forward. They compete all over the world.
Yeah. To follow up?
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
It cannot have been news to anybody that Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips have competing projects elsewhere. That's not news. And I guess it comes again. Are you seeing any impacts in the progress of the AKLNG cooperation by the producers, given the governor's turn?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I have not seen any at this point in time. I think the governor made a point to contact the presidents of the various companies prior to making the announcement and to let them know what his thoughts were. And so far, I think the only real issue that we're going to have to deal with in the short term is the idea of who can work on which project to make sure that we keep the firewalls in place on the state side. Not so much that there's a second project, but just how to make sure that the information doesn't bleed over from one project to the next.
My understanding. Follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
My understanding is one of the benefits of the previous alignment or juxtaposition of the two projects was that there was the opportunity to share information, and that by creating a firewall, you're increasing the cost of both projects. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that would be a reasonable expectation that by having the two projects that the costs will go up.
All right.
Chair, to follow up on that.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Chair. Mr. Hoffbeck, we've had two projects for a long time, and the proponents of the ASAP project have always said by having two projects you put some pressure on the oil companies, and now the narrative is changing. So I guess my question to you is, doesn't it benefit the state for us to let the majors know that we're committed to that project, but if they don't move ahead, we have other options? Does that not give us a little bit of negotiating leverage?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that is the case. And from my experience with the negotiations on stranded gas, when the state is in the room in a weak position, that is not a good place to negotiate from. I actually think this strengthens the state's hands in the negotiation, but doesn't necessarily have to slow down the process, shouldn't slow down the process, but it will keep everybody, it just levels the playing field. Thank you.
All right. Are there any further questions of Mr. Hoffbeck? And
I do have an additional.
You have one more. Representative Sadler, one more.
I'm going to sweep back. Just a question I'd like to try and ask the other designees. Has there been any specific understanding with you and the governor as to what will make you a successful commissioner? At the end of 4 years, did you have a conversation before you decided to take the appointment as to what it would mean to be a successful commissioner?
We did talk about two issues in specifically. One was revenue shortfalls and having a long-term economic plan to deal with those shortfalls. And the second was that we will have failed if we don't have a gas line that's in feed and moving towards an investment decision.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Just to follow up on that, Mr. Hoffbeck, you said that your goal was to have a plan for the revenues and the revenue shortfalls, I believe is what you said, and a plan to move forward on gas pipelines. So can you share what your plans are?
Through the chair, for the revenue shortfalls or for the gas pipeline? I don't know that I can add any more than what I've said already, but except for the fact that we did talk about the idea that this really is an opportunity to rethink government on the revenue side. What is it that government should be providing? What is the core services, and what are areas where we've essentially strayed from those core services that we maybe can't afford going forward? So that was probably the only thing I could add to what I've already said.
Core services sounds familiar, huh?
Mm-hmm. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just continuing in that line of thought here is, should we expect to see the administration leading in the conversation? One of the challenges I've seen in this year is that whether it was marijuana, whether it's Medicaid reform, some of these other areas, I've been waiting for the administration to step up and lead in some of these areas. And as we talk about revenue changes, revenue discussions, will we see the administration leading through whether it's legislation or the governor starting the conversation, or will there be an expectation that the legislature is going to have to step up to the plate and deal with that conversation?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think the governor has laid out the plan for this year, which is that we need to get our own house in order first. And so that's why we haven't moved forward with any kind of revenue programs or really teeing up those discussions. My conversations with the governor is that he is more than willing to lead on that. Once he feels like people are ready for that discussion, he's more than willing to lead that discussion.
All right. Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
What if they're not ready?
Well, definition of ready.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we're going to need to work this together, which means it's going to take the public, it's going to take the private sector, it's going to take the legislature, it's going to take the governor. We're all going to need to work together on this. Right now, I don't believe that the public is convinced that the state is operating as efficiently as it needs to operate. And so for us to tee up a conversation now, I think would not be constructive. I think in this first round of cuts, the public isn't going to feel that much about it. I think most of that was is really taking out those areas where multiple years of robust revenues was easy to throw money at a problem rather than fix it. And so to this first round of cuts, we're pulling back the money and actually having to fix some of the issues. But going into next year, if the revenues are still at this rate, we are going to have to propose some fairly significant cuts. cuts in programs. And at that point in time, I think people will be ready to talk because the balance will be what do we want for programs versus are we willing to pay for them? And so I think the process itself will bring people to the table, but this isn't the time right now.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
I agree with the governor that we got to start with the cuts, but that's back to where my frustration was. As he said, we need to start with the cuts, but I'm still waiting to see from the administration the leadership in telling us what we should do to bring about those cuts. Starting with this legislature and the process we're going through, I'd like to see a little bit more, and that's not necessarily your department, but I'd like to see a little bit more of the stepping up to the plate and helping us understand what he expects government to look like in the next couple of years. That will help us help you as we move forward.
Final question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't need the governor to tell us what to do. Just take that message back. So you said significant cuts, okay? I'm trying a 10% cut in one area, and I about got crucified. So what is a significant enough, you know, by percentage that would make or allow that discussion to happen in the public?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we've made cuts that are, even with the additional cuts that the House is going to offer up, something probably less than 10%. The governor's says that over the next couple of years, we need to get to 25%. There isn't another 15% that can be pared out of government. It will be programs that need to be cut. And I think that's when you'll start seeing the public become interested and, you know, whose program gets cut versus whose gets saved. So it's not, I don't know that it's a dollar. I think it's a focus, and I think by next year we're going to be talking programs.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson, and then we'll move on.
I don't think our savings lasts. For 25% cuts in the next 3 or 4 years overall, not per year, you know, we can do the math and figure we're almost $4 billion now. We're at about the same amount with the governor's cuts because, like you said, a lot of them were kind of taking out vacancies and things, so that's, you know, $7.5-8 billion. You know, that cuts more than half of what we have at this point. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out, you know, has there been some kind of chart done between what you assume the revenue will be and significant? I mean, if we don't start putting those numbers out there for the public to understand that if we don't make a certain percentage or a certain number, we have no savings, and then the discussion really becomes crisis versus a discussion. So do you really think that we can make it with just a 25% cut over the next 3 or 4 years?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have about $9.5 billion in savings at the end of this fiscal year. If we look at another $3.5 billion next year, we're at $6 billion. And if the prices stay as oil prices stay as low as they are, we will definitely have to start finding other ways to balance the budget. We can't cut ourselves into a balanced budget. That's not possible. And so the discussion on where the revenues are going to come from is going to have to be on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we could tax our way out of it either.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoffbeck, for being here today. I'd like to remind members of the House Finance Committee that signing the report regarding the appointment of Commissioner-designee Randall Hoffbeck in no way reflects individual members' approval or disapproval of the appointee. The committee's report accompanies the nominations, which will be forwarded to the full legislature for the confirmation or rejection. In accordance with AS 2460-130, the House Finance Committee, having reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointment of the commissioner of the Department of Revenue, moves Mr. Hoffbeck's name to the full legislature for confirmation. And now I will take a brief at ease while the members sign the report. Okay, we're back on the record. Next on the agenda is House Bill 26, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives and providing for an effective date. This bill is by Representative Olson, and here to present the bill is his staff, Laura Steidolf. This is the first committee hearing on this bill, and I do not plan on moving the bill away from committee today. We will be hearing the bill and hear invited testimony. And go ahead and place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Steidolf, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is HB 26. This legislation extends the termination date for the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives to June 30th, 2017. Each year, the Division of Legislative Audit reviews state boards and commissions to determine if they should be reestablished per AS 2444. The Division of Legislative Audit reviewed the activities of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether there is a demonstrated public need for the board's continued existence and whether it has been operating in an effective manner. As the members noted in their review of the audit in their packets, it is the opinion of the Division of Legislative Audit that the board be extended 2 years to June 30th, 2017. You saw that in the opinion of our auditors, the board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing certified direct entry midwives and apprentices. Additionally, it was found that the board continues to improve the profession by modifying and adopting midwifery regulations to conform to current standards of care. As the members also may have noted from the audit, there were four findings and recommendations, including having the department pursue disciplinary cases, increasing licensing fees to eliminate the board's operating deficit, having the board communicate certificate requirements to continuing education providers, as well as approving apprentice applications in accordance with statutes. To speak to the recommendations, Chris Curtis of Legislative Audit is here. Sarah Chambers of the Department of Commerce is here to speak on the fiscal note, and Cheryl Korick, the board chair, is online from Anchorage. In closing, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives serves an important role in protecting the well-being of Alaskans by identifying individuals who are willing to pursue technical training and meet specified technical qualifications necessary for licenses as midwives. The continuation of this board is very important to the health and safety of Alaska's women and children. Thank you for your support of this legislation.
Okay. Representative Newman has a question, Ms. Steidolf.
Maybe this is for Ms. Curtis.
All right. Further questions, Ms. Steidolf? Seeing none, Ms. Curtis, would you go ahead and place yourself on the record? And we have questions, and we'll hear any comments you have.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I represent the Division of Legislative Audit. Chair Thompson, would you prefer I address the question, or should I go through the comments?
Go ahead through your comments first.
As Laura mentioned, we did conduct a sunset audit of this board. Purpose of the audit is to determine whether the board is operating in the public's interest and whether it should be extended. We did conclude that the board is operating in the public's interest. However, we also concluded that staff with the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, DCBPL, failed to operate in the public's interest by not pursuing timely disciplinary sanctions related to four midwife investigations. Because of the serious deficiency, we recommend only a two-year extension. We did have four recommendations. The most significant was to the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development's commissioner, and that was to take immediate action to pursue disciplinary sanctions for midwife cases when warranted. The audit found that disciplinary sanctions were not pursued for four investigations involving two people when the investigations concluded that sanctions were necessary. In all four cases, the respondents refused to sign a consent agreement. And rather than file an accusation and pursue an administrative hearing, DCBPL staff followed alternate procedures. Two of the four cases were forwarded to the Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecution and Appeals, OSPA, for processing. And the audit found that those cases remained at OSPA for over a year without action. According to OSPA, those cases represented their lowest priority as the offenses were categorized as Class B misdemeanors. Due to staff turnover, we could not determine why DCBPL staff did not pursue civil licensing action as required by their standard operating procedures. At a minimum, licensing action should be pursued concurrently with criminal action to ensure the public is protected from incompetent, negligent, or unlicensed practitioners. By not pursuing licensing action, the respondents were allowed to continue to practice and the public's safety was placed at risk. That was the most significant of recommendation, and as Laura already discussed, we did have three operational recommendations.
All right. Representative Newman, then Sadler, then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Curtis, I'm looking. It looks like the board did a very good job. They were serving the public. Kind of looks like they went beyond to make sure that they were trying to improve themselves and the profession by modifying and adopting regulations to conform with current standards of care. They're doing a great job. But the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, the particularly Division of Corporation Business Professional Licensing, your four recommendations are there to get their act together. So why would the midwifery only board only receive a two-year extension on their sunset date because the board's not doing their job? And we would expect to see only a two-year extension on the sunset date of every board that comes in front of us because professional business license is not doing their job?
Representative Newman, through the chair. Typically when we find issues in the division that need correction, we're in a position to come back the next year when we do our another occupational board sunset and follow up, especially when these issues are things related to cross-cutting issues like a system or a procedure that is central to all of the occupations. In this case, the investigations are specifically related to this particular board, and the sunset mechanism is the only mechanism we have for follow-up to ensure that given the seriousness of these deficiencies, that we do come back and review the operations to ensure that they're corrected. So I do agree that this board, we have found that they're operating in the public's interest, and all four of these recommendations are, three of the four are to the division, and one of them is to the two of them are to the board and two of them are to the division. And the two to the board are fairly simple housekeeping type recommendations that wouldn't warrant a change to their extension.
Follow up, Representative Newman.
It's a common practice that we see in corporation business license that they're not getting their job done.
Representative Newman, through the chair. We do not see something like this when we look at investigations, and we do look at investigations for all of the boards. This was something unusual. We don't feel it is characteristic of the division's practices, and we feel it's very significant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Curtis, has the Department, Corporation Profession Business License, have they responded to Recommendation 1 and the findings yet?
Through the chair, yes, their responses are included in the back of the audit, and they both the board and the department concurred with the recommendations.
Other questions on other recommendations? Is now the right time to ask?
Pardon?
I've got questions on the other recommendations. Do you want to finish this topic and move on, or can I ask a different question?
We've got others, but they might be on new subject also, so go ahead and follow up.
Well, okay, I'll ask on the recommendation two regarding the license fee changes. I was looking at the history here and see that there's been a deficit in the midwives board since at least FY 2010. What has been the source of making up those deficits? Can you tell us?
Recommendation Sadler, through the chair. I can't address how they're making up the deficit. That would be a good question for the department. Right. However, I can give some perspective on that. When we last did our audit in 2006, we found that this board was suffering from a deficit. And at that point, they had the highest fee of any occupation at over $2,000 for their fee. So this is not a new problem for this board. They've had a lot of investigation costs, and they have a very few number of licensees to bear those costs.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question comes down to a lot of the problems we see with these boards, and that is, did the investigation expenses come as a result of investigating people not licensed? So sometimes the boards absorb costs that they're pursuing legal actions against people that aren't licensed and aren't part of the board, and then the people that are licensed have to pay the cost of the people that aren't licensed. Is that the case here?
Through the chair.
Department of Commerce question, possibly?
Possibly. I'm not sure to what extent we can share the details of the four cases, but in general terms, I can say that when we do go into an occupational board and look at investigations, it is not unusual to have pressed to find an investigation related to unlicensed activity.
So I guess
follow-up.
I don't need details of the number of cases, but is the expense a result of dealing with people who aren't licensed? I guess is my question.
The chair, partially, yes.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back on number two, recommendation number two. So do you know, I didn't read anything in here on why it seems like it continues on the direct expenditures growing to such an extent, especially if they already pay a high fee. Is there anything that makes this appear that this will keep growing at this rate in the next few years?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, on page 14 and 15, we do have some information about the fees from FY10 through FY14. And knowing that in 2006 they had a significant deficit and their fees were over 2,000, I find it somewhat unusual that in FY10 their certification fee was 500. So expenditures and revenues, you know, you can increase the revenues. Too low of a fee could have driven the deficit. Then certainly looking at the investigations, we know that they had four significant investigations that happened. So that also drove the fee. So on page 14, you do have a little bit of more detail on what where the fees, where the expenditures were, where they occurred.
Follow up,
Representative Wilson.
No, because I guess maybe I didn't ask it, but in 2010, total direct expenditures were $22,600, and then it's $31,049, and then, you know, $64,000. So it's almost, I mean, it could be those four cases, but is this board looking at another $20,000 hit in 14 and another one in 15? I mean, if it keeps going this rate, I understand why the deficit part happens, which is completely different than the growth of expenditures. And I guess I've just seen if there's a trend where, you know, if you even go back to $2,000 per person, you're still going to have an issue if it keeps growing at that rate.
Through the chair, I think the department probably could provide you, especially more up-to-date, where they're at on their deficit. Another thing that can drive their personal service costs is regulation or statutory projects. So that whenever you see a blip, that's typically either an investigation or some type of regulatory project.
And one final question.
Representative Wilson.
On the audits, so do we know how much this audit cost for this board? And, you know, and if not, why are these audit charges not charged back to the boards? That's part of the requirement of being one.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, as part of LBNA and legislative audits budget, they have personal services to do their work, and their work encompasses the financial audit, the federal compliance audits, and sunset audits, and special request audits. To my knowledge, there's never been a move to charge these monitoring costs to boards.
Might be something we might want to look into. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Curtis. And now I'd like to bring up Sarah Chambers from the Department of Commerce. Welcome. Place yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I am the Acting Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing.
You've heard some of the questions. Do you want to make any statements to start, or do you just want to go into more questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to give a little bit of an encapsulation of our response to the audit findings. As Ms. Curtis said, we did concur with the audit findings, and as is the case in many of our audits, we're very pleased to have the audit process help us to uncover some things that need to be improved, and we agreed that this was a serious need for improvement. In the last year, we've had quite a few changes in management and our management structure of our investigative unit. It has been a process over the last few years to improve our case management system, which we have been doing, and now we're putting those changes into action. So since the audit findings came out, we have worked more closely with the Department of Law and the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals to make sure that those processes are codified and that we are not just sending cases over to the Department of Law and letting them languish or waiting for them to fall into the priority status that we think that they may be. So we have our chief investigator, Angela Burt, has set up a 30-day meeting for our staff as well as Department of Law staff to touch base and make sure that the cases we send over are being acted upon. And in this situation right now, to be responsive to the specific audit findings, we are working on those cases and are closing in on some definitive action on these that were particular to this audit finding.
Ms. Chambers, how many registered midwives are there?
There are approximately 50 registered midwives, including apprentices. So it is one of the smallest programs that we have, and it's also one of the smallest, if not the smallest, that has the added expense of a board.
With a $115,000 deficit and $5,500 a year physical note showing, are they going to be able to catch up, pay the yearly fees, and catch up in on that old $115,000 deficit?
Mr. Chairman, the board and the division have been working really closely over the last few years to chip away at the deficit. It would be untenable for this profession to continue to grow to a $4,000, $5,000 licensing fee. It would almost certainly put them, many of them, out of business, which would lower the number of licensees to share the cost and service to the public. So we are in concert with some of the guidance over the years that has been identified through the prior administrations as well as legislative finance and legislative audit. We are not anticipating to recover that cost in one licensing cycle, but over a period of time, the board and the division with the board's concurrence increased licensing fees the last two cycles and will continue to do so. The $500 deficit was, or the $500 fee, which was a quite an anomaly in the higher fees that this board has experienced over the last many years, predated any of our current management's involvement, but we understand that over a period of time, the division prior to 2010 was providing boards with some information that was not being reconciled to the state accounting system, and the board may have been given incorrect information and not setting fees high enough, which is where we found a few of our boards incurring larger deficits that, again, we're having to chip away at over a series of cycles.
Is there any fear that increasing the fees is going to possibly reduce the number of midwives because the fees get so high? I mean, is that a concern?
Mr. Chairman, it's definitely a concern. It's a concern that I hear regularly from a variety of boards. However, as long as the professions are required to pay all of the fees, including those for unlicensed practice and investigations, it's a cost of doing business.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the way I read the Alaska statute, though, we really don't have a choice. And the way it reads is that we can't chip it away, is that every year you're supposed to do the books divided by how many there are, and that would be what the fee is. So I'm just trying to, I mean, I understand maybe 2010 was a problem, but in 11, 12, 13, it doesn't look like that work was done. So what gives you the authority, I guess, to not make that happen?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's been a question that we've wanted to clarify since the special audit from 2011. We have received guidance from both Legislative Finance and Legislative Audit that have said that their interpretations of AS 0801065 require us to analyze fees every year, but not necessarily set fees each year to recoup the cost. Again, that's a statutory interpretation and could be open to future interpretation.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I don't know why we'd analyze them and not do anything. I guess I have another question. Follow up, please. So if this board were to go away and they would still have to, my understanding is they still have to be licensed, why would they still not be a safe industry if they didn't have a board? I mean, they still would have to get a license. They would still have to do whatever that license required, whether that was to get extra classes or whatever is mandated for that license. So what does the board do to keep safe versus the same thing you could do if you had a professional license, besides not to pay for people who don't do it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe that we do maintain safety for all programs, whether there is a board or not. The board allows the profession to have very timely and professional insight into a variety of regulatory issues, whether it's keeping current with continuing education and standards of practice. Chairman Cheryl Corrick of the board is online for any questions, so since she is a board member and the chairperson, she may be able to add more light from a practical standpoint on why the board adds additional value.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
And really, this is, you know, not based that particular board, but for any board. So could they not do it voluntarily? I mean, get together, discuss this, do their education without having to incur these? I just don't know how you're going to ever make it with 50 people, you know, with the rates that we're seeing at. So they're going to continuously be in a deficit, you know, which maybe we need to change this. But I'm just trying to figure out why they could still not do that, not in this board form, and still accomplish what you're saying they do with additional costs.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the model that often is used in with programs that don't have boards is when the division is proposing regulations or when we receive feedback from professions, say construction contractors, for example, they don't have a board. Then we do receive quite a bit of input from the professional community and the associations. Those professions don't have the statutory authority to take action as this board does, so meeting informally would be a process that would have to be compatible with the Open Meetings Act and the regulations drafting process. But as far as adding value as a board, there is definitely value in keeping current with continuing education, with practice. We saw last year with the Practice Act for the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives remove a section from statute and move it into regulation for that specific purpose. That may be a nuance that our licensing staff wouldn't catch and wouldn't be aware of. So again, it would be at the will of the legislature. One of the ideas that's been discussed, not formally within our agency, but I've heard discussion of in this theoretical concepts, is could this board's activity be assumed by another board, such as the Board of Nursing or the Medical Board? And it's possible that would be it would definitely do away with the deficit, because you're absorbing those 50 people into an existing board as opposed to 50 people having their own board. But again, I'm sure that Cheryl Corrick, the board chair, would have a different, would have her own particular view on whether that would serve the need of the midwife community.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Just a couple of brief questions. The extension recommendation was for 2 years as opposed to what, how many years standard?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the legislative audit has the ability to extend up to 8 years.
Okay. So it's anywhere from 0 to 8 years. Okay. Two more questions. How long has this board been operating? How long has it existed in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't have that particular date with me, but that may be one that Cheryl Corrett can answer.
And last question, if I could. What percent of the what percent of births in Alaska are facilitated or attended by direct entry midwives in Alaska?
Again, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's more of an industry question.
Okay. We'll ask Cheryl when she comes up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we're back to a larger structural problem that we've dealt with before and we haven't resolved. And for Ms. Curtis's, my comment to question to Ms. Curtis is how many of these result from these costs, these prosecutions, these investigations result from dealing with people in the industry who aren't licensed. And we've had, this is a considerable problem across all the boards and commissions. And the questions become, the boards and commissions are functioning by themselves, with their members, with statutory authority and regulation, fine. It's the when they have to reach out and prosecute and investigate, or investigate and prosecute people that aren't licensed. And who pays for that? I mean, this is a tiny board. This is 50 people. A certain percentage of them are apprentices. Is it the state's responsibility to prosecute or to pursue people who aren't licensed, who are outside of the authority, or do we put the burden of the people not participating on the people that are? And I think that's the larger question that we have to deal with, and we keep having these deficits in these small, this is definitely a small board, 50 people. I don't know how we deal with that. We're absorbing the cost regardless. I think we should just figure out what to do and not burden these people that have licenses that are trying to go about doing businesses, doing the people's work and doing it well, and have a larger discussion, which I think we've had before but never resolved. So how many boards are in trouble financially because of prosecutions of outside or investigations of people outside of their regulatory authority, their boards. And this is just one more.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we don't have a particular statistic, a percentage, but each board does pursue those who are practicing unlicensed who come to the attention of our investigative unit. That may range anywhere from a wage and hour investigator from the Department of Labor doing his review of our his enforcement of our statutes while he's out in the field anyway, finding that someone is constructing a building or working on a building without a license, to a medical professional working without a license or anywhere in between. So each one of our licensing programs does have in statute that requirement, and each program does pay the cost of investigation.
So just to follow up, I'd like for us to get back to House Bill 26 instead of talking about carpenters and other builders around in the Department of Commerce, if you don't mind. We're talking about the board for the midwives, and we know they're in a deficit. They're working on it. Let's try to stick with that instead of trying to go off into how many others. Ms. Chambers, well, we do have a couple more questions. Representative Pruitt?
I'll stay with the bill, but I want to keep with the relevance of if they do find someone that's working that's not licensed, and, of course, they're bearing the cost, and, of course, that's part of the deficit. Do you have the authority to go after that individual that was not licensed to recoup the cost of the investigation as well as any additional fines that can help limit the cost to, in this case, the midwives? Do you have that authority to do that? And if so, is it acted upon? Do you utilize that opportunity?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, right now, we do not have the authority to receipt the fines back into our division. Right now, any fines that we collect go to the general fund. So the boards and the licensees, with or without a board, especially in this case, cover those costs. We have been working on an attorney's opinion on whether we can bill, as it were, the licensee or the unlicensed person who may be found to have committed a licensing violation for the specific investigative costs of that investigation. So that is something that we are working out with our attorneys. But regarding fines, we do not currently have that authority within our legislative, the legislative intent language for our budget.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead with Representative Kawasaki, and then we're going to go to Ms. Corey and have her have a little bit of time yet left to respond.
Recommendation two, or Ms. Cork mentioned in recommendation two that the board has actually requested increase to licenses for not only CDMs but to the apprentice license fees, and it looks like the board saw it as a way to meet shortfall, but the board request was denied the past 2 years. Can you give me a little background on why that might have been?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that request did not was not completed until late last year when I did increase those fees. So that has already been resolved.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Gaddis, and then we'll move to Ms. Corey.
And I'll speak to the bill. So, and I know you spoke about it, too, a little bit, but what happens if we say let it sunset this summer? Hmm. So clearly, you know, the board goes away. It doesn't have to collect any more fees. It doesn't need any more fees. I mean, what happens? What happens to midwives at that point?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, my understanding is that this is a sunset of the board and not the licensing program. So the board would go away and the licensing program would continue. That may be a more technical question with a range of options that Auditor Curtis would be able to answer.
Okay, thank you. And I know you spoke to that already. I just didn't, it didn't click. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Chambers. Right now we're going to go to Fairbanks and Cheryl Corrick, who is the chair of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. Cheryl, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Place yourself on the record. Tell us your titles. And you've heard questions. If you could maybe go into those, or do you have a statement on any of this?
Sure. I'll start with my statement, and then I did want to address some of those questions. So our board is a very important
would you
part
place,
of this
place
profession.
Your, place yourself on the record, please, your name. And
I'm sorry. Yes, my name is Cheryl Cork. I'm the chair of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, and wanted to just say that our board is a very important part of this profession. It works hard to appropriately regulate and update midwifery in Alaska for CDMs, which are Certified Direct Entry Midwives. The two areas we're working hard to improve are budget and investigations. Angela Burt is the new chief of investigations, and she's diligently restructuring their division's investigative procedures and priorities to address our board's concerns. Previous investigative practices, as outlined in the legislative audit, delayed the process at the risk of public safety and the costs incurred were significant. The board is optimistic that the improvements implemented by Ms. Burt and her investigative staff will be effective. The budget deficit is of particular concern to the board and to the licensees. The administration of CBPL and Director Chambers has been working with us to implement cost-saving measures, particularly administrative overhead. We've raised license fees and plan to eliminate the deficit over several licensing periods. Now, as to some of the questions, I apologize that I may not remember who asked them. The one fee that was $500 in 2010, I just wanted it to be part of the record here that I was on the board at that time, and the board, as well as the licensees, were very concerned about that fee being so low and actually asked if we could raise it in order to have a bit of a cushion because we knew these costs would continue to come up. And we were told no, that basically these fees are set. They come before the board, and we have very little say in what these fees are. The budget is done, and that's what we were told. We have to approve these fees, but we really don't set them ourselves. So that was a concern of ours at that time. The board itself, I believe, has been in existence since about 1988, and births in Alaska attended by midwives are about 10%, maybe a little bit less than 10% of the births done in the state. Let's see. I believe Representative Wilson was asking why it would be less safe to not have a board for certified direct entry midwives, and Director Chambers answered some of that with the CEUs and the regulation and statutes. And I just want to add to that, we have a obstetrician and a certified nurse midwife on our board, as well as two direct entry midwives and a public member. And the team works really hard to ensure that the regulations are not just to public safety, but to remain updated with national standards, which, of course, does tie into public safety, as well as keeping current on the type of CEUs that are needed and just the language of the regulations, which changes pretty regularly in the national standards. And so we do work really hard on just keeping updated and keeping the profession updated, and I believe that's necessary. One add, it's a volunteer board, of course, like all of our boards are, but the cost of the board is pretty minimal. Most of these costs are administrative and investigative in nature. I don't see where that would change without a board. The volunteer board costs our profession between $4,000 and $6,000 a year. Thank you very much. I'm available for any more questions.
Questions of Ms. Corrick. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Ms. Corrick. Are the investigations, the four investigations ongoing, are they related to uncertified activity?
They don't give us a lot of information on those either, but my understanding is at least one or two of them are.
Okay. And do you have any estimation of the number of uncertified midwives that may be practicing in Alaska, anecdotally?
Anecdotally, I would say probably two.
Just two. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Corrick, on the second page of your letter back to the auditors in Recommendation 4, you mentioned that you are researching the possibility of a legal defense fund to help smaller professions with the cost of investigations. I'd be curious to know more about that, and you're working with other professions to do that, or is that simply the DEMs, rather?
Well, we're certainly interested in working with other professions, and this is a topic that's been coming up at board meetings, and we've spoken to, I believe, Ms. Milks about it, as well as Ms. Chambers during these board meetings. We haven't really had any action as of yet on this. I'm trying to recall there was a bill introduced last year that pretty much addressed the same sorts of things and would have provided a fund, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the bill, but it did get shot down last year in the legislature, and so we were kind of hopeful that that would go through and would address it, but it did not, so now we're kind of starting over again on this.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Any further questions from the committee? All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Corrick, and also I want to thank Ms. Chambers and Ms. Curtis and Ms. Seidolf. At this time, I'm going to set House Bill 26 aside. It will be coming back before us under bills previously heard. Okay, tomorrow's House Finance Committee meeting will start at 1:30 p.m. here in this room, 519. We'll hear House Bill 39, followed by a presentation from the Pew Charitable Trust on the recidivism reduction discussion that we began last week. And with that, at 3:16, we are adjourned.